Special shout out to Shulak's brother. All right, so it's Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Just got back from a religious conference that left me somewhat cloistered for the last 24 hours. So I couldn't find something that I came in through the door and I was looking for. So I've asked Harry Shearer to come on and talk about it to help me out because I can't actually find it. An hour from now, it's Heaven, Our Enduring Fascination with the Afterlife, Lisa Miller, Time Magazine reporter and writer, amongst other things. She has done a comprehensive survey of the history of heaven. When did it start? And there's kind of like an actual beginning point on the timeline of our understanding of heaven. When did we actually start to use the word heaven? How has the perceptions of paradise changed over the millennia? More specifically, how often it changes just between generations. So we'll talk about heaven, what we know about heaven, or what we think we know about heaven, and what people used to think of about heaven. And we'll do this from both the perspective of Christians and Jews and Muslims, all three different perceptions of heaven over time. What are true? What are myths about different religious perceptions of heaven, too, coming up next hour on Coast to Coast. A little bit later on this hour, James Childs, of course, a regular guest on Coast to Coast, an expert on technology at the verge, on the verge of breaking down. His books on inviting disaster, on looking at how technology failed just before some of the most famous disasters in our times, made it to a History Channel piece a couple of years ago, and he's coming on to tell us a little bit more about what's happening on the ocean floor. But that brings me back to Harry Shearer, and we'll get to him coming up in just 1 minute. Harry Shearer on what's actually going on in New Orleans. Harry Shearer is a well-known advocate for New Orleans, a dedicated a fan of Louisiana and the Gulf Coast. And he was on a press conference panel on like a symposium on Friday. Couldn't find any details about it anywhere. I've been looking on the internet. I thought it was fascinating what I was hearing Harry Shearer talk about, but it's not getting any mainstream press support. So we'll find out more about that coming up next, live from New Orleans on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. I remember when the headline came. Oh. Get a little slapback. I remember when the headline came out from when Harry Shearer's new album Greed and Fear was released. It referred to Harry Shearer as, so I think it was a Times Picayune review in New Orleans, and they said, it either said Harry Shearer, comedian and part-time New Orleans resident, or New Orleans resident and part-time comedian. I'm not sure, but either way, it was a pretty good review of your most recent album. So I remind people, Greed and Fear is out there. And good evening, Harry.
Good evening, Ian. I'm a part-time guest on your show, too.
So Greed and Fear seems to be well in place in this subject of the oil spill in New Orleans, don't you think?
Yeah, coincidentally, it does. And, you know, it's pretty remarkable. The city had been really in a period starting pretty much when the Saints got to the Super Bowl and then won it, and on the same weekend the end of the era of Ray Nagin came to an end as mayor. There seemed to have been a real lifting of the entire mood of the city. It almost levitated into a sense of, okay, the post-Katrina era is now over, and we get 2 months of that, and as Dan Rather used to say on the CBS radio network, now this.
Yeah. And were you still in the middle of making your documentary about Katrina when the oil spill happened?
Yes, we just are locking it this weekend, as a matter of fact.
Will that change how you shoot the documentary you were doing on the aftermath of Katrina?
No, because our film was not about the aftermath of Katrina. The film was about the cause of the flood of the city.
All right.
That story doesn't change. It has been underreported, to put it mildly. And it has still been underreported, even as the oil spill story has been. I don't know. I think it's too early to say how well or poorly reported the oil spill story has been. Clearly, I think it's safe to say at this point that reporting has been done has been despite the best efforts of BP.
Well, you know, it was interesting. I was listening on a satellite feed to this symposium. Is that what it was, in New Orleans on Friday?
It was actually a worldwide broadcast for the BBC.
Okay.
And they assembled a group of people who ranged from the son of a third-generation fisherman who was probably not going to go into the family business, the head of a mental health clinic in St. Bernard Parish, which is one of the most seriously affected parishes or counties, a couple of professors, Garland Robinette, who is a locally famous, and if you, he's been in Spike Lee's film and Brian Williams' newscast, radio talk show host, a famous New Orleans chef, John Besh, head of the Louisiana Seafood Council, and me.
Yeah. It was interesting because it did seem like, though, that many of you were hinting at things that weren't getting a lot of mainstream coverage. And some of that appears to be, and I don't know where you are, as the oil is, you know, is lapping up on, sadly, in so many areas in New Orleans, on what this is doing to the psyche of New Orleans or of Louisiana in general, that had already been suffering from this sort of it seemed like an underreported mental health crisis still going on in that part of the country.
Absolutely. The aftermath of the flooding was a major mental health crisis in this city, exacerbated by the fact that about 80% of the mental health professionals left town after the flood and did not return. The city, you know, people in this city have been expert self-medicators in the best of times. I think the dosage just increased in every sense of the word. You know, I do want to correct something you said. There is no oil lapping up in New Orleans. The closest we've come is during the springtime, during the early part of this crisis, when there would be a prevailing wind from the east. You could walk out in the French Quarter and smell the volatile compounds that had evaporated off the surface of the Gulf and had wafted into town. But the areas that are actually seeing the oil are along the coastal marshes that are
the wetland areas. I would have thought that was connected. I'm sorry. So that interesting. So the idea of all of the people that are feeling a little. I mean, I guess again, we're talking about money having to make the difference here, and so how is it adding up for the people of Louisiana? Do you see another, if you will, sort of post-Katrina gap between what's happening and what you all need?
Well, you know, the difference is that in New Orleans, the poorest of the poor really did not get the resources they needed to help them come back, and about 100,000 exiles are still not here. Everybody else used whatever they could scrape together, family, friends, community, volunteers from around the country, faith-based and otherwise, the occasional insurance payment, the occasional government payment, compensation, to come back. We're talking in this situation about, in terms of the coastal economy, about people who may not be able to do what they've been doing for a living for three, four generations. If the shrimp aren't there, the shrimpers are out of business. No matter what resources are applied, that's gone. And it may take 10 years, it may take 20 years. Meantime, they have to feed their families. So the whoever has been doing it may not continue to do it. Now, that's a very different situation, which has both economic and cultural implications. You know, this was an economy of family businesses, which ran smack into an economy of a multinational corporation. And it's odd because they've been living kind of cheek by jowl in close proximity. People in the same family, one person would work in the fishing or shrimping industry and another would work in the oil rigs. But it's come to this weird juxtaposition where these family-owned businesses are going to be wiped out by this multinational corporation.
We're talking with Harry Scherer, part-time New Orleans resident, full-time comedian. And you, and when I was listening to this BBC broadcast, there was somebody that stood up and said very specifically, I believe, don't let they can't stop drilling for oil. Don't let them, we need that business. Is that the consensus of everybody in Louisiana?
I believe that was Garland Robinette from WWL Radio. He was basically saying, you know, what a lot of people hear. That's a reflection of what I was just saying, is that the oil business and the seafood business have been the twin engines of the economy of South Louisiana, and one being crippled and now the other one being put on hold. There are those, and you know, I have to say, Ian, I don't know anything about remediating a deep water oil spill, which of course qualifies me to run BP. but you know what? I do know a few facts, and one of them is that it's fairly well established by people who know what they're talking about that it shouldn't take 6 months, which is the length of this moratorium, to tighten whatever regulatory regime needs to be tightened. It's an arbitrary time limit, and it's arbitrary in the sense that it's going to have this severe effect on people here. But you know, if I were the president, and I'm not, I just pinched myself to remind myself of that. you know, people say, well, what can the guy do? And there are people who defend him are saying, you know, what's he supposed to do? And you know, there's this sort of bizarre show going on where every week he flies down here to basically. Do you remember when George Bush, the father, visited, I believe it was a market in New England, and the reporters caught him. He had a 3x5 card in his collection of things that were his talking points, and it said, "Message, I care."
Right.
And we've been watching the "Message, I Care" tour by President Obama, and his supporters say, "Well, what can he do? He can't fix the spill," and that's absolutely right. But what he could do, I think, with a stroke of the famous pen, is adopt Canada's rule for oil exploration. It's called the same season rule, and it's basically this: if you're going to drill an exploratory well at the same time you drill a relief well. And gee, if that had been the case in this country at the time that the Deepwater Horizon exploded, the relief well would be there now, and the gusher would have ended long since, instead of waiting for the relief well to be drilled ad hoc come August.
Is everybody in New Orleans dying to know the name of the guy from BP who is on the Deepwater Horizon rig, and according to published reports, was the one that actually sort of bigfooted the idea of dismantling the Deepwater Horizon in the proper way?
The company guy, as he was referred to.
Yeah, the company guy. Aren't he dying to know his name?
Yes, I think so. Those hearings were pretty remarkable. They were held right next door in the western suburb of Kenner. And that was a pretty remarkable set of hearings that got remarkably little attention, I thought.
Well, I remember reading the reports of it. They said, you know, here's a guy from Transocean who was saying there was almost literally like a fist fight over how they were going to disconnect the rig, and the guy from BP, you know, he kind of cudgeled everybody else into going along with him, and they were actually saying, I mean, they were screaming at him, you know, this is not the safest way to do it. Yeah. And it turned out it was the safest way versus the cheapest way, or at least so he thought.
Well, you know, there was, I remember the testimony of one of the guys on the rig saying, you know, we're going to do it Bud's way because Bud's way has always worked and it's the safest. And then the company guy came in and said, we're going to do it my way.
Right.
And that started the contretemps, shall we say. Yeah, right. I mean, and, you know, it's that's those details get lost in this kabuki that we do in modern America, which is, well, we're not going to get into finger-pointing. There's no time for finger-pointing. We're not going to blame game. No, let's wait until everybody's memories are shot and then go back and try to piece it together what happened.
No, I'm pretty sure he was in the taxi cab that they found Joran van der Sloot in. I think he's the guy's on the run. I think he's we're giving him a good head start. Interpol will never find him. They BP should pony up that guy's name. If there's anybody who's responsible for it, it's that one guy who said, no, we're going to do it my way.
Exactly. Well, you reminded me of the fact that BP's last-ditch solution is to try to stop the leak, is to shove Joram van der Sloot in this.
Yeah, I think we'd all be behind that. Well, very good. I will continue to listen for your wisdom as you share it weekly on your radio show, and also If you get a chance to, let's have you back on. I've always wanted to have you on with the Spinal Tap. So if we can ever arrange that, that'd be great. I know you guys, you're hard to get. I know, hard to get in a room. I'll talk to you soon. Thanks, Harry.
Too loud for your show.
We'll make allowances.
Thank you.
Thanks, Harry. Have a good night. God bless. That's Harry Shearer live from New Orleans, from his new album Greed and Fear, which you can link up to find that at Coast to Coast. We had him on not too long ago, and he's always interesting. But most importantly, he has become a very vocal advocate for New Orleans because of this pipe spill. Jim Chiles is a regular guest here on Coast to Coast, although it's been a while. He writes for, you know, like Smithsonian, and he's written several books. And we love to talk about him on the subjects of invention and technology, especially when it fails. Good evening, James Chiles.
Hello, Ian.
So you've been following this this pipeline spill. I asked you if you'd take a look and tell me what you see that's going on the ocean floor. What is it that, and what is the hope that they're going to get this thing shut down?
The blowout, not a spill and not a leak. That's my feeling. It's a gusher.
No,
they used to call it a gusher.
Right.
Yeah, they're watching the 12-screen feed from, it's on NPR and many other places. I'm watching the cameras move around, most of them fixed on that big, ugly cloud coming out of the top hat. Watching one camera go down the riser, I had a chance to hang with the guys on the Discover Enterprise about 10 years ago when they were at a pretty similar stage to when the blowout happened here on the Macondo. Well, so it's, I spent my time with the Oceaneering crew mainly.
The Macondo well, talk about that.
Well, that Macondo, that's the particular lease that BP and its partners, Mitsui and Anadarko, they had leased from the notorious minerals management and people of the United States. So Macondo was the actual name of the lease block, 252, as I recall. The location I was at on the Discovery Enterprise was a different well, then called Crazy Horse, Crazy Horse Field Number 2.
So what are the hopes as you study, you know, how technology fails and then how we recover from it? What do you think is going to happen with this blowout on the ocean floor?
Well, the as your previous guest was saying, the only real way to take care of this, unfortunately, is the relief well. And I'd say the odds are good they'll get it the first time, but we're still talking 2 months, you know, a terrible ordeal for anyone living on the Gulf or thinking about the ecology, or people who are planning to go down there. So the relief well is the only way to take care of it. I'd have to say the industry was in something of a denial mode. I did talk to a blowout expert named Larry Flack with Boots and Coots about that whole subject of deep water blowouts, and at least he told me they didn't think it was a problem 10 years ago, that they could handle it. Of course, he didn't think of the rig itself catching fire and blowing up and sinking. But I'd say the industry was reasonably confident they could get on top of it. In fact, they held a conference 10 years ago where they looked at a scenario very similar to what happened on the Macondo prospect. Deep water blowout, the BOP not working, gas and oil coming out. So they have been thinking about this. They just haven't done very much.
So there are no more tricks up anybody's sleeve at this point. It's whatever has been tried and failed will be it. And then after this, it's just a matter of waiting out the constant oil.
Well, there would have been other things. I've been looking through some of the citizen comments, some interesting things. And, you may remember Hedy Lamarr.
Sure.
Came up, you know, with a good idea during World War II, frequency hopping. So it certainly happens that ordinary people like you and me do contribute things to a highly technical field. Her particular idea had to do with preventing the enemy from intercepting our messages.
Right.
And so the ideas people have come up with, it's hard to know whether BP has read them. They said they have. The main problem is it takes so much time to prepare those, and the relief well would probably come along faster.
Okay. So by the time maybe they could work out what are those plans somebody is submitting on the internet, they might as well have the relief well dug. Well, I like going back to Harry's idea too about you don't dig one until you've got a relief well ready to go along with it. Thank you. Again, the book is Inviting Disaster. It's a classic. James Childs, Lessons from the Edge of Technology. Keep an eye on that, and we'd love to have you back on too. We'll do open lines coming up next. We'll take us that into the top of the hour. You can talk about this if you got a suggestion on how you think we could plug that hole. But after that, Heaven, our enduring fascination with the afterlife, coming up on Coast to Coast. So we've posted the numbers there. Now it's your turn. We'll do open lines all the way up to the top of the hour. Where do you want to take the show? Anything we've talked about so far, or if and you want to. If you've been online, there's great stories at coasttocoastam.com, including that haunted radio mystery. I want to believe this, but I have a problem with it. The story is a 70-year-old radio is spooking listeners by picking up vintage broadcasts featuring Winston Churchill and the big band music of Glenn Miller. Stranger still, and you're hearing this coming, the seemingly haunted radio is not connected to any power source. That's online at coasttocoastam.com. Now, it goes on to talk about how this is at an old RAF base with a long history of paranormal activity, right? So if you go online, take a look at that story, you'll see it. And here's my only caveat to believing it, is that was a plot on Nanny and the Professor. I remember that so clearly. Remember that old show, Nanny and the Professor? And she had a radio where she could listen to broadcasts from the 1930s. And I was like, okay, this is that, right? This is the same thing. That does remind me, I was looking at the new Sea Crane catalog, and they've got a retro radio. It's a very cool looking radio. I wish I just I can't believe everybody doesn't love these. It's a classic British retro radio. So it looks like the real thing, but of course, this is the latest technology in it because it's from Sea Crane. You got to take a look at that Sea Crane catalog. Very cool. All right. So back to open lines. Where are you going to take this show? Any of the stories online at coasttocoastam.com? The subject that's coming up on Heaven and/or anything else that's in the news or on your mind next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. All right. Let's get to as many of these open line calls as we can between now and the top of the hour. Sorry, I had to move my microphone there. That sounds very subtle. Hear a big squeak. I'm going to ask if Jesse back in the studio could bring up Jim west of the Rockies in Grand Junction, Colorado on Coast to Coast. Jim?
Yes, Ian. By the way, I'm listening to you guys on a 1930 Atwater Kent Cathedral radio.
A real one or a retro one?
Yes, a real one.
Oh, that's cool.
On the Exxon Valdez oil spill, they had some kind of a oil-eating bacteria that they turned loose, and it actually would only live a certain length of time, or they'd have to turn a bunch more loose, but that's all it ate was the oil. And to me, this would be the answer right now.
Well, I would think if that, I mean, I would think, and I could be wrong, that anything they would have, they would be using. I can't believe if it did work that they wouldn't be using it because BP's going to be paying some big money on this. So yeah, I don't know. If it worked, why not? Maybe it could it be that it's too big an area and they don't have enough bacteria to cover a spill that big?
Well, it would be a great thing, if it did work and they could, if they have enough of it.
Yeah. Good question. I'm going to go look that up, see if I can't find out why they're not using that. Peter, first time caller line, Reading, Pennsylvania on Coast to Coast. Peter?
The garden spot of North America. Anyway, you derailed my train of thought with your little report there, but so I have to add this. I had a cell phone a couple of years back here in Pennsylvania that didn't work very well, but in the middle of the night, out of nowhere, I would hear the voice of Vin Scully reporting baseball in Los Angeles on KABC,
Right.
and it didn't even have a radio feature.
Wow. Okay, that is cool.
As far as the oil-eating bacteria, the problem is in wetlands where the water doesn't move much, the bacteria deoxygenates the water, kills everything, not only eats the oil.
Now, I'm looking, just because you mentioned it too, and I happened to Google it and found a story from May 4th that says that they're willing, the guy who makes this was willing to turn over his entire production line to the patented oil-eating bugs to help mitigate the future environmental damage along the Gulf Coast. But they don't explain that what you just said, but that wouldn't surprise me. It seemed to be that they're not quite ready with it yet. But that's
they're already large portions of the Gulf that don't have oxygen in just because of the lack of movement and all the algae, and it would just exacerbate that situation. My wondering in the beginning of this was why they don't just scuttle some ships and pour concrete in over top of it just to stop it, number one. And then number two,
why not?
Mr. Shearer, who I love, but he's one of those liberals. I consider myself a leftist Republican, pro-death leftist Republican. They already are being accused of being socialists. Why doesn't he just play the card of seizing everything that BP has, nationalize them?
Well, I don't know that he's talking about that. I don't think he's talking about
nationalism. No, I mean, the liberals are always that they go, they lean a little bit left.
Well,
and
I don't think anybody wants BP. You know, I really don't. I mean, I don't know if you're going to take over a company, why don't you take over a viable one?
The $300 billion every quarter in profits, pretty viable.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I don't know what the liability spreadsheet looks like these days,
yeah.
But I mean, I don't know about taking over, and I certainly haven't heard Harry say anything about taking over BP. I think it would be a dumb idea. I think it's better to make them pay for every last penny they have to pay to get the Gulf cleaned up, to get the things back. If people are losing their livelihoods through no fault of their own, BP ought to pay for that too. So yeah, I want them to keep making money so that they keep paying off everybody who needs the money back. They may not make a profit for about 10 years, and that'd be all right with me. Carl is in Jonesville or Johnsonville, Carl?
Oh, Johnsonville.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
You may have seen this. There's a pretty cool vintage Soviet education / propaganda video you can find on YouTube. If you look around for it, it tells the story of how they sealed up one big blowout. It was a gas well blowout on land. And what they did, and I guess they did it more than once, this wasn't the only time they did it, is they drilled a parallel hole. Instead of a relief well, they drilled a parallel hole, lowered a small nuke down in it, and blew it off. And the nuclear warhead just crushed the structure, so it crushed the... you know, the well bore that was the blowout well bore crushed it closed. Of course, you couldn't do that now. I mean, it'd be politically unthinkable. It's perfectly feasible technologically, but now
talked about it. Actually, I've heard a couple of people talk about the feasibility of that. I think the problem is it's not a guarantee.
No, but it wouldn't. Well, here, I think what you could do now is you could probably use some kind of conventional high explosive, something like Astrolite. It's a liquid explosive. You drill a parallel well. And by the way, the Soviets could only do it with a nuclear weapon because the drilling was so inaccurate back then in the 60s and early 70s. Now it's far more accurate. They know exactly where they are. So you could get so much closer to the
right,
the blowout hole. You know, it's kind of like the weapons trade off between accuracy and required yield. You know, the more accurate the missiles get, you don't need as big of a yield to do the job. Same thing would be true in this kind of technique to stop a blowout. If you could get close enough, you could pour liquid explosive down there, set it off, crush the structure.
Well, you'd think we already know where exactly it is. So, I mean, if that'd work, gosh darn it, anything at this point. But as to the nuclear option, I heard as of just Thursday that nobody in the administration is seriously considering that. But that makes you think, if they're not seriously considering it, they're still playing that out at the back of their head. You know, I mean,
I suspect that even the even a conventional, you know, if you could get really close to it and use a conventional high explosive,
right?
Even that's probably politically incorrect.
No, I appreciate that. Thank you, Carl. I appreciate that. In fact, Jesse, I'm going to ask you if you could give me Henry in Texas too. I've had there's a disconnect on my phone over here. So Henry in Texas, another wild card line on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Henry.
Yeah, I don't think they want to turn it off. I think they split the casing somewhere down in the bedrock, and if they turn it off there, it's going to start coming up hundreds of miles from there because that's a giant crater. And they're going to have a problem from Colombia to Cuba to all over the Caribbean. The whole area will be filled with oil coming up in all these places that they'll have no control over whatsoever. I don't think they want to turn it off. If they wanted to, they could have. Didn't they send a shear down there to finish off what the saw didn't do? Well, they could have put the shear down there a few days ago with a dull bit on it and just clamped the thing shut. They didn't do that. It's still spewing oil out into the Gulf out of that one pipe. I do believe that they have ruined the pipe 3 or 4 miles down or 2 or 3 miles down into the dirt where they put it, and they can't turn it off because it will just come up 100 miles from there through the cracks in the bedrock.
I have no way of knowing one way or another, but that's an interesting theory.
Just half-inch casing pipe they've stuck 4 miles into the ground. Right. That's basically the same pipe that runs natural gas out in front of your house.
Like I said, I have no way of proving whether you're right or you're wrong, but thanks, Henry. Let me get to Cornelius, and he's in Louisiana. He's got a vested interest in this on a wild card line, and then I guess everybody wants to talk oil. Cornelius, is that you too?
Yes, sir. Ian, God bless you and your call screener, Gina, and Tommy and George. I want to thank all of y'all at Coast to Coast for bringing this out and bringing on guests that's talking about this, because nobody cares. A lot of people getting sick down here and stuff. So I just wanted to say thank you and God bless you. And may all the Coast to Coast viewers and listeners pray for us down here.
Yeah,
thank you, Ian.
We got you in mind, Cornelius. We really do. In fact, thank you. Rob is in New Orleans on Coast to Coast. Rob?
Yes, hi, Ian. How are you?
Good. Go ahead.
Yes, I have a vested interest, too. Living down here near the Gulf, it's heartbreaking. And I was watching on the BP live broadcast over the Internet when they were trying to cap that pipe. And it's ridiculous. They're trying to do it the most difficult way possible. If you could see a picture of it, when they were doing it, there's a flange where the original pipe that went up to the rig, there's a flange that has several bolts holding it to a secondary flange on the riser. The simple thing would have been to clamp that that flange together, take out the bolts, take out that defective piece of pipe, attach a new piece with a new pipe going up with a valve in it, and then just close the valve.
Well, it certainly sounds easy enough. Why didn't they do it?
Well, I was watching them, first of all, when they cut the pipe with that scissors-type device.
Right.
They crimped it. And then they were trying to get it straightened out again using a diamond bit saw. And it just made it worse.
Is it incompetence?
You know, I don't know. This is the most simple project. I mean, an engineer probably thinks he has to engineer. But yeah. The simple thing was, the way it's designed, it could have been replaced.
I appreciate that thought. And you know that we're thinking about you, too, down in New Orleans. Hope we get a solution on that. Mark is in the on the international line on Coast to Coast as we work our way to the top of the hour. And Heaven, our enduring fascination with the afterlife. It's a survey of the history of heaven. Go ahead, Mark.
Hi, is this Ian?
Yeah.
I'm calling you from Canada. I've got 20 years experience on the biggest pipeline in the world up here in Canada. And I really care because my little girl, we can't kill any more flippers, you know what I mean?
Right.
So when I looked at the problem, it was quite a bit, you're in a better shape than I thought you were. Now, the best way to understand it is to get everybody to watch the old John Wayne movie, Hellfighters.
Okay.
Everybody's working... Everybody's working. I've got a lot of experience. 20 years of it. I'm an analytical troubleshooter. I was an operator on these big systems. I've actually opened risers with my hands. now up here in Canada with natural gas. Now, what's fascinating about this is that it is so fixable. However, the average person doesn't understand some of the anomalies. Now, what we need to do is not work against the pressure, but with it. It's more of a pipelining problem than a rigging problem. I've also worked on rigs in my life. Now, what they require is a larger diameter valve over top of the BOP. They can't put another BOP on top because it's so heavy. Okay? Now, the problem with valves is that they're working with such high pressure down there, they might not actually be able to turn a normal valve. Valves are lighter than BOPs, and what they require is a valve that goes at a 45-degree angle.
Okay.
With some paddles underneath the valve so that the 26,000 pounds coming out of that hole will actually help to pull that valve shut.
Well, that's why aren't the people in New Orleans getting this right? How come they haven't figured this out at BP, Mark?
Oh, that's such a good question. I've seen things in industry that happen, and I've seen blunders over blunders. And we tend to overcomplicate sometimes when we should be addressing the simple. I like the caller that was a bit earlier that talked a little bit about some anomalies with respect to the pressure under the ground. But they never had those problems before the rig went down. So I don't think they're a bit of a concern. I just think that things have gotten hog wild. And I'm really considering forwarding some of this information. I'm just trying to get – I have to do something. I have to contact.
Well, if you got it, send it through. Let's hope they're still reading them. And thank you, Mark. Let's go to Tim, who's been hanging on the longest. We'll try to get to as many as we can before the top of the hour. Open lines, Tim, west of the Rockies.
East of the Rockies line. Green,
oh, you're east. Glad to have you.
Yes, sir. I came up with a theory of why this is going on. And I think it fulfills the Bible prophecy in Revelation chapter 8, verse 8, where the second angel sounds, and as it were, a great mountain burning with fire was cast into the sea. And the third part of the sea became blood. And the third part of the creatures which were in the sea and had life died. And the third part of the ships were destroyed. Now, this is Revelation 8, verses 8 and 9. And it's interesting because the Apostle John would have no idea what an oil rig on fire would look like other than comparing it to a great mountain burning on fire. And it being cast in the sea and just merely means it just disappears into the sea. But if I understand right, the oil coming up there, it's kind of a reddish color, giving a bloody look to it.
Okay.
And all the creatures in the sea.
So you think this is as forecast in Revelation, so what will happen next then?
Good question. Last year I was reading on a website. It was on Patrick Cook's BibleUFO.com.
Okay.
And the article up there was that the Euphrates River is drying up, and his link to it was to the New York Times, and I believe it was July 15th of 2009 last year, talked about how the Euphrates River is starting to dry up, which, according to Revelation 16, prepares the way for the kings of the East. There's just so much going on. There's a lot of problems.
Yeah, listen, you know, what would be the next thing that's coming then? To go along with it, what would happen next?
Well, the next angel that sounds talks about a great star from heaven, something coming down from the sky, from space, burning as it were a lamp, falls on the earth, and the rivers and fountains of waters, and they become wormwood.
All right. Well, then that's what we'll be.
That's any better.
That's what we'll be waiting for, according to your interpretation of Revelation. Wild card line. We have time. Do we have time for Francis in downtown L.A.? Francis.
I wanted to ask you. I should know because I was there. What body of water was Noah in when he got swallowed by the whale?
Noah was not swallowed by the whale.
Well, who was? Oh, not Noah. What was?
You talking about Jonah?
Jonah, I'm sorry.
He was on his way to Nineveh.
Mm-hmm.
So the body of water next to Nineveh. I don't know. Let's see. Here it is, Lake Erie. No, I'm just kidding. I'll go look that up for you. But yeah, all we know is that he at that moment didn't end up going to heaven. Our enduring fascination with the afterlife, Lisa Miller, coming up next. We'll talk about the history of heaven. When was, and there's actually kind of almost a date for this, when was heaven invented, or at least nuanced, to be called heaven? and to be described as heaven for the very first time. We'll talk about that coming up next hour on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett.